Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Hi everyone, welcome back to another Books with Hooks. We have a special guest joining us today. Carly, will you please introduce her?
Absolutely. This is a very special guest. This is somebody who I've been on the writers conference circuit with for at least 10 years, crossing paths on airplanes across North America, an incredible agent, a friend of mine, and I'm very excited to introduce you guys to Mary C. Moore. Mary C. Moore is a literary agent with Avidus Creative Management based in the Bay Area. She has represented the Nebula nominated The Unbroken by C.L. Clarke and the Indie Next and Book of the Month pick The Keeper of Night by Kylie Lee Baker. She loves working with writers to launch and develop their careers primarily in middle grade YA and adult fiction. In her time off, you can find her either in the garden or on the pickleball court. So thank you for making time for us today, Mary.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here and to talk about speculative fiction.
Amazing. So right, we're going to kick it off and dive right in as we normally do. Cece, will you please read us the first query?
Dear Cece, thank you and Carly so much for hosting the Shit No One Tells You About Writing podcast. It inspired me to make the push from first draft to final manuscript. Note, this is a resubmission with a revised query letter and opening pages. I am seeking representation for my 86,000-word upmarket speculative fiction novel, The Viridian Experiences, where 23-year-old Chinese-American Kira must save her virtual world by entering the real one, then determine in which world she truly belongs. Adventurous yet pragmatic Kira has always lived in Viridian. The shared virtual reality was created by Beyond Inc., where her parents work, to temporarily shelter most Americans while the real world, or IRL, heals from climate change. But her parents have grown inexplicably distant, and her friends don't understand her increasing ennui and alienation. Then her estranged cousin Tate reappears and claims there exists a second Viridian. After visiting Tate's Viridian via a hack, Kira discovers more Viridians, some mundane, some surreal, some horrifying. She learns she's the only human left in hers, and her friends, actually AI-generated, hinder her from leaving. She claws her way to climate-ravaged IRL New York to find a skeleton crew of Beyond employees, including her Chinese mother, spearheading its restoration. To investigate the proliferating Viridians, Kira begins working at Beyond alongside her mother and finds friendship and romance with other young employees. She uncovers the flaw in Beyond's AI. It is optimizing for residents' personal preferences over their collective well-being. Beyond's well-meaning but underqualified CEO is following his board's plan: ignore the flaw while repairing IRL. He's in denial that by the planned return, the residents' Viridians will have grown too disparate for them to adjust to IRL. To fix the divergences herself, Kira must confront Beyond's AI and the board protecting it. Then, as her new friends start returning to the reunified Viridian, she must decide whether her future lies in Viridian with them or IRL with her mother. The Viridian experiences will appeal to fans of The Space Between Worlds and The Immortal King Rao. It also includes Asian family dynamics and strange multiverses, similar to Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. My short stories have appeared in Luna Station Quarterly, Translunars, Traveler's Lounge, and Infinite Worlds. I was selected for Kearney Street Workshop Interdisciplinary Writers Labs 2023 cohort. The Viridian Experiences draws inspiration from my work as a software engineer in San Francisco. I've attached the first 5 pages below. Best regards, Sherry Yan.
Awesome, Cece. Thank you. Before we hand across to Mary, can you give us an indication of what the word count was there?
The word count is 408 words.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Mary, we're handing it across to you to hear what you think.
Okay. So firstly, I mean, the concept behind this is fantastic. You know, I felt that one of the big things in science fiction is a lot of science fiction tends to fall in a tropey kind of area. And in general, it's really important that, I mean, your science fiction manuscript is going to fall in a trope because it's sci-fi, just as you would in romance or fantasy, you're following a certain genre. And so it's really, really important to pick out the pieces that stand out and make your sci-fi fresh and a fresh take on all of them. And, you know, in general, I was really interested in the concept. However, I will say that the pitch itself, so I'm talking about starting with adventurous yet pragmatic Kira and ending with IRL with her mother, that pitch was very dense and a little bit hard to kind of pick out what was actually happening. And I found myself reading it twice. And as you all know, you know, as agents read queries, we wouldn't read it twice when we're actually reading cold queries. So that's something to think about. And a common problem that happens in sci-fi and in fantasy is there's a lot of eagerness to really explain the world building, explain your world behind it, add your sort of names that you've made up for your world. But what ends up happening when you do that in a pitch, because the reader of the pitch is totally unfamiliar with what you've got, you know, this amazing world I'm sure that you've built within your manuscript, we are going in kind of, you have to think of it as we're going in blind. And so when you use a lot of words like Viridian, IRL, Beyond Incorporated, you know, when you add a lot of that kind of stuff in and then you throw it in a pitch, it leads to a lot of vagueness and confusion. So my recommendation in this particular query would actually be, and I recommend this actually a lot with sci-fi queries, is to tone down the world building language and really try to focus on what's at stake here. And, you know, if you look at, so I will say that the comp titles are fantastic. You know, they hit right in that kind of crossover sci-fi space that Sherry is indicating her book is in. They did really well. They're award winners. And, you know, I was instantly like, wow, if, you know, if she's nailing this sort of literary crossover space, this book could do really well. If you read the back covers of those two comp titles, you'll actually see that they don't list, I mean, they do talk about multiverses and things like that, but they don't list the names of the multi, you know, they don't list the names of various factions that are happening within the book. It's all about just the characters themselves and what's happening. So, you know, I wrote a little example of what I'm talking about here. So I'm just going to read, you know, what I wrote here. It said, Earth has nearly been destroyed by climate change, and so humanity has resorted to living in a shared virtual reality until the planet heals. Adventurous yet pragmatic Kira is content with her life, mostly. She's not sure why her parents have grown really distant, or why her friends seem to have no interest in keeping tabs on what's happening in the real world, but she makes the best of it. And so, as you can see, I kind of removed a lot of the world-building sort of information, but keeping the content of what Sherry's trying to get across with this query. And that, I would say for sci-fi, is a common mistake. And it's not necessarily even a mistake. This query was good enough that I would jump to the sample pages. But because sci-fi is such a tight, competitive market, and because there's so much of it out there, and particularly for Sherry, because she's going for, you know, a wider crossover audience, you know, you really want to hone that pitch into something that is very clear on what you're trying to come across with your characters. And the point of the manuscript isn't about virtual reality. It isn't about this like overlord company. You know, it's much more about her relationship with her mother and humanity's crisis and things like that. And the last thing I would say before we kind of open up for conversation is I love the draws inspiration for my work as a software engineer in San Francisco, but I would love to see you open up a little bit more about what that means. Having experience in the field, even as fiction writers, you know, having experience that you can draw on that adds to your story is wonderful and definitely very interesting for the agent. So I would recommend, though, instead of just saying draws inspiration for my work as a software engineer, what inspiration? You know, did you notice something within your offices, or have you noticed something within, you know, your community that is kind of concerning or just interesting or intriguing, and that brought you to think, hey, what if I wrote a story about that?
Love that, Mary. Thank you so much. Okay, Cece, what did you want to add to that?
I'm obsessed with your rewrite, Mary. Thank you so much for that. You know, when I'm looking at a query letter, I always go to the major dramatic question, and I always spend extra time focusing on that because that should really like convey the stakes, convey the emotional heart of the story. And your major dramatic question here is whether she decides to live in with her mother in real life or in Viridian with everyone else. And that's a relationship-based major dramatic question. And so, to Mary's point, I think it's really important that you focus on the relationships in the plot paragraph, because we got world, and then a major dramatic question that was about the relationships. And I love relationship-based stories. I will read a good relationship-based story in any space. So I think it's, you know, really important to really focus on that, focus on how the plot and the heart of the story has to do with the relationships first and foremost.
Wonderful, Cece. Thank you. Okay, could you give us a summary of what's in those opening pages? And then we're going to hand it across to Mary for her thoughts on those.
So we have our protagonist, Kira, at a cafe, and she's texting her friends, and they're trying to figure out what to do tonight. And you can tell she's not very excited about much. Suddenly, there's an update to the system, kind of like we have updates on our phone, like software updates, and a new nightclub opens up. And so in this text exchange with her friends, they decide to go to the new nightclub. And she is outside now when she sees a woman running and then a man running after her. And another man shows up in this woman's path, and he takes out something black and shiny from his pocket, flashes it in his hand, and the woman vanishes. And two people see this, but they kind of shrug it off. And Kira's like gasping out loud because no one else seems to pay attention other than her to this woman who just vanished. One of the men walk up to her, and she hopes it's just a coincidence, but then he says her name, "You are Kira Shia." And then, you know, she thinks to herself, am I in trouble? She answers her full name, and then she's let go. And yeah, that's what happens.
Wonderful, Cece. Okay, Mary, we'd love to hear your thoughts on these opening pages.
Yes, of course. So the opposite is true from what I was saying about the query letter, right? When you are writing sci-fi and fantasy, the world building is so important. And I think in this case, Sherry really nailed the world building. You know, it's very rich. It's very detailed. We instantly feel like we're in this, you know, weird sort of matrix-y type world that, you know, perhaps is a little bit off, but not quite. You know, I love the details of something like her friends not being interested in seeing real life, things like that. That being said, the genre that Sherry particularly is going for is this crossover space. And, you know, crossover space is a delicate balance to walk because, you know, if you're a sci-fi fan and you're trying to write in the crossover space, you're going to lean heavily into the sci-fi area. Whereas crossover space, the whole point of the crossover space is that you're trying to reach an audience that doesn't normally read sci-fi. And so in that particular case, I would say that with the sample that I've read, and if I was representing and editing this particular sample, I would tell her, okay, there's two things I would suggest here. I'd suggest you need to ramp up the tension just a little bit. And that can be done within the prose itself, or it can be done by adding, you know, a little bit more action. However, you do have quite a bit of action here. So I would lean towards the prose, ramping up the tension within the prose. The other part is that the prose itself needs to be a little bit more elevated to reach that sort of crossover space, to reach those sort of book club fiction people that you're looking for. And I can suggest, you know, your comp titles were actually really wonderful. So I would suggest going back to your comp titles, rereading, you know, a couple pages of them and just really seeing how the authors create this amazing sort of tension and beauty. Not that your prose is, it is beautiful and it is, you know, you do have a really good basis here, but it's just not quite at that level that would cause editors to kind of have a feeding frenzy, because I think your concept could potentially cause that feeding frenzy, but you do need to follow it up with that elevated prose here. So that would be my commentary on it. So I would say that you're very comfortably building a world that is very clear. And so I think that you don't need to focus on that so much anymore and just really kind of hone in on the prose at the level of the prose itself.
Thank you, Mary. Yeah, something I'm seeing a lot of lately with emerging authors is they will be like, critique this, but tell me just what you think of the plot and the characterization and the tension and the curiosity seeds. And they go, I'll worry about the writing at a sentence level later. And that's like saying you're going to try and build a house without bricks, right? You're going to build a house and you'll worry about the bricks later. And you cannot build something beautiful when it comes to writing without the writing being there at the sentence level. I would rather, as writers, that you take 2 years off from writing a book, from a particular story, and really just practice on elevating at the sentence level. Write anything, write everything, just focus on those sentences, and then you can come back and build a house, rather than being like, well, I've built this thing, but there aren't any bricks, but don't worry about that, I'll worry about the bricks later.
I do want to follow up and clarify on this, particularly with Sherry's query, and this is why it's really interesting, there's so many differences with speculative, but Sherry is aiming for an audience that is not your commercial sci-fi audience. If she was aiming for commercial sci-fi, I would actually say her prose is fine. You know, it's not necessarily going a huge book club route, but it is very clear. It is very visual. And I can feel, you know, myself in that world. So for genre sci-fi, commercial genre sci-fi, I wouldn't necessarily have her go back and really try to elevate that prose. But it's because of the target audience that she's wishing to achieve. And I think important for all writers to really think about, like, you know, where do you want your book to land on the shelf? And I believe that Sherry has an understanding that maybe a lot of writers don't even have yet. And so she's actually ahead of the game with that. However, her prose isn't quite getting to that point. So that was my...
Yeah, excellent point, Mary. Okay, Cece?
This was such a good... I just thank you so much, Mary. Thank you so much for everything that you're saying. I don't rep sci-fi myself, not like heavy world building sci-fi, kind of like this. And so it's so interesting to get to see how you react to these pages. Thank you so much for those notes. I'll mention a couple things that I wish I had seen because I feel like it would perhaps help with the tension, but also help just make her character feel more real to me. So I really wanted to see Kira interpreting what other people are doing, which is an interiority technique. And I'll give you two examples. You know, she's texting with her friends, and one of her friends, Charlotte, has an ex, and the party is at this guy's house, this ex's house. So she has a best friend, her best friend has an ex, the party's at his house. And Charlotte texts, still undecided if I'll go, but you don't have to skip it for me. And then all we get are the texts after that. Now, if I'm someone's best friend, I know whether they mean it or not. I might be wrong, but I have a very strong opinion. I go, she's saying that, but she doesn't want us to go. She'll be upset if we go. Or maybe I'll think something like, oh my gosh, to be such an elevated spirit. Like, I would totally mind, but I know Charlotte. Charlotte's the kind of person who actually wouldn't mind if I went, you know? Whatever her opinion is, it's really important to have that zooming out moment. And we're only talking about a few words, a sentence or two, but it does help us as readers connect with the protagonist to see that inner life playing out. It's super, super important. Another big example, which I think can go a long way in terms of tension, is when she sees this woman running. Like, I've lived in different cities in my life. If I'm in Rio de Janeiro and I see a woman running, I think someone's trying to mug her. I'm sorry. It is what I think. It is sad, but it is the reality of life in Rio de Janeiro. You know, living in New York, I was probably assumed that she's running to catch, I don't know, late for a meeting, for the subway. She could still be being mugged. It could be a million different reasons, right? But you see a woman running, a man is running after her. What do you assume? Do you assume assault? Do you assume, I don't know, whatever it could be. I don't even know if crime is still a thing in this world. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But I wanted her head forming theories. The guy who knows her name, is it normal that these people know her name? These people of this level in this world? If not, her head needs to be thinking of theories. Why does he know her name? This is not normal. Like, it just needed more of her thinking in a way that really, really makes its story forward and curiosity inducing. Because to me, that's what makes me connect with a protagonist. And that is what I love in all stories.
I was just going to say, Cece, that is such great feedback and definitely a way for Sherry to sort of up her tension and up, you know, this sort of crossover space, book club space that she's looking to get into.
Wonderful. Okay, now we're going to go to our second query. Will you please read that for us, Carly?
Hello, Cece, Carly, and Bianca. First, I'd just like to thank you for all the content and knowledge you provide with Tis Not Ya and Books with Hooks. I've only recently discovered the show, but have already heard an incredible amount of useful and applicable information to apply to my writing and query letter. Second, I know sci-fi isn't a genre either of you request on your manuscript wishlist pages. However, the helpful feedback I hear on other query letters is outstanding, and I had to try my hand at receiving some of my own. Thank you for everything you do. Tis Not Ya is a consistent beacon of motivation and inspiration to writers everywhere and to me. And to this author, this is why we have Mary on the show today, and we know our limits and we're always willing to bring somebody in to help us out. Okay, now let's get to the query letter. Dear Cece and Carly, I'm writing to seek representation for my novel, Embers Fallen, a first-person sci-fi thriller. At 75,000 words, Embers Fallen is a standalone novel exploring self-destruction and self-discovery. Tigran only wants three things in life: to rid the world of the Vedanthi, the otherworldly species that enslaved Earth, to find his lost sister, and his next drink. It's been over a decade since the Vedanthi War of 2137, and the city of Exlanta wilts under extraterrestrial rule. As the member of the Embers, the remnants of global military, Tigran spends his nights being a thorn in the Vedanthi side, conducting a menagerie of ambushes and sabotage. He spends his days searching for Emily and fills the gaps with whiskey. After intercepting a Vedanthi transmission, Tigran and the Embers discover that the Vedanthi have been working on a world-ending weapon and are nearing completion. As the Embers race against time to uncover and dismantle the cataclysmic weapon, Tigran starts experiencing gaps in time, memory loss, and other strange occurrences. Fear of being bench-ridden, Tigran hides the anomalies from the other Embers. Tensions mount as his comrades attribute his lack of accountability to the bottle, but he knows it's something more sinister. An unexpected friendship forces him to confront his past decisions and himself, all while he struggles to fulfill his duty as an Ember and hide the growing list of anomalies. Things turn for the worse when Tigran discovers his role in the world-ending weapon isn't the one he thinks it is. Embers Fallen is my debut novel, and I've begun working on my next. I have an associate degree in web and graphic design and have worked as a software developer for over a decade in the tech industry. I use that experience to layer in social commentary on technology and marketing in today's society. Thank you so much for your time and consideration. I look forward to hearing from you. Again, thank you for your time. Drew Clements.
Thank you so much, Carly. Before we hand to Mary, can you tell us the word count there?
All right. The query itself comes in at 334 words.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay, Mary, over to you.
Yes. So you're going to hear a lot of the similar things that I've already said for the first query, but this one actually is a slightly different genre. I mean, it's still sci-fi, but Drew, he is clearly aiming for the commercial sci-fi market. It would be best if he had a couple comp titles that he could tell us, you know, that's exactly what he's aiming for. You know, when you looked at Sherry's query, we were able to see right away, you know, where she wants to be on the shelf. With this one, I assume, given the parameters of the query, but if Drew has an interest in going anywhere else besides that kind of commercial sci-fi, now would be the time to come up with some comp titles to just ensure that that's the direction he's wanting to go. I will say that, again, talking about this is a common thing that most sci-fi and fantasy, and maybe even historical writers do in their pitch letters, is they just put way too much world building information in there. And this is a great example of it. You know, if I was reading this pitch in a cold query, I would be stumbling over all of these terms. So you've got Verdanti, you've got Alex Lenta, you've got the Verdanti War, you've got the Embers, you know, and you have Tigran, which is a kind of unusual name. And so if you kind of almost do like they call it a Monet, right? You step back and just look at the paragraph, it's just going to be littered with a lot of words that you don't know. And as a reader, again, you have to remember that the reader of this pitch does not know your very strong world, you know, like all of your details. And so we're coming into this blind, and you have to think like that. The reader is coming into this blind. They have no idea about your world, and you do not need to explain it in your pitch. So this is super key for sci-fi writers and fantasy writers. You don't have to explain all of that. You know, all you need to do is tell us the stakes of what's happening so that we read your sample pages. In my case, you know, often when I read cold queries, I understand that. And so I will actually skip right to the sample pages if I start stumbling over kind of too many world building details in the pitch. However, the other thing about sci-fi is it tends to be, as we talked about, you know, there tends to be a lot of stereotypes, a lot of tropes, you know, and this is an example of that. I mean, we've all read that story, or sci-fi readers have all read that story of alien overlords and, you know, Earth on the brink of collapse and the lone rebel who's going to save us all. That is a common theme in sci-fi. That doesn't mean that it won't sell. It doesn't mean that it's not a good idea. It just means that if you're pitching it, it's more important for you to pitch it in a way that's going to be like, oh yeah, I'm so excited to read this, versus something that's just very heavy with the world building details. I would say try to use more common terms for your titles. So you want to use a term that will define your unusual world building term rather than using the term itself. So in the case of the Verdanti, you don't have to use that. You can just say alien overlords, right, in your pitch. And that explains what they are without you having to explain them. The other aspect of this, something like Ajax Lentia, you could use capital city or humanity's last remaining stronghold, something like that. That's going to explain, you know, what this space is without having to give us a term. And then the embers can actually just be the rebels. So that all being said, you know, it is okay and actually encouraged to throw in maybe one or two of the interesting terms, but don't use them as a crutch and don't rely on them as a way to create, you know, your space. You know, and then looking at this, I can see there's humor here, you know, and there's glimpses of it, but it's so overwhelmed by, you know, the terminology that he's using that it's kind of like erasing the strength of this pitch. So I did another little sample here, and I cannot mimic Drew's humor. And so I just tried to do it as basic as possible, and with the hope that, you know, he could take that and then kind of run with it and add his little bits of humor. But I said, Tigran only wants few things in life: to find his lost sister and his next drink. Oh, and to rid the world of humanity's alien overlords. He spends his days searching for Emily and his nights waging guerrilla warfare with his fellow human rebels, the Embers. He fills in the gaps with whiskey. When the Embers intercept communication that an alien weapon of mass destruction is nearing completion, and Tigran starts to experience strange time jumps and loss of memory, etc., etc., etc. As you can see, I wiped away almost all of the sort of world-building details to really get to the crux of what's happening. And I did throw in the Embers as a way to say, hey, you know, this is a world-building rich concept, but you don't want to take away from what's actually happening, the concept and the pitch. And then I will also mention, you know, the same thing that actually happened in Sherry's query is there's this, you know, quote in his bio that says, I use that experience to layer in social commentary on technology and marketing into today's society. I think that's great, but if you can link the two more, my experience as a software developer has given me a deeper understanding of how technology and marketing affects today's society, and I try to explore those concepts here. So you want to avoid telling us that, you know, I did this, and rather just say, hey, this is what I was attempting to do. Because, you know, if you're telling us that's what you do and then you don't achieve it, that's going to be a kind of a problem. Whereas if you just say, this is what I'm attempting to do, that gives the agent a little bit more space to say like, oh, I see what he's trying to do. Let's see what I can do to help him here. You know, as you can hear, there's a lot of similarities in my critique of this one and the other one. The only difference is that Sherry knew, you know, where she wanted to be on the shelf. And so I specified individually towards her query what I would recommend. And without that sort of specification from Drew, I wasn't able to do that. And that's also something to think about in terms of, you know, when an agent's reading your query, our vision for what your book is going to be is super important for us to hit, take that next step, even just requesting your full. And if that vision's not there, which it was, you know, in this particular case, I was like, I think there's humor here and I can see this potential, but it wasn't becoming very clear. And so I think really good comp titles, really good current comp titles would help in this situation and kind of making your query more concise and allowing that humor that was there to really shine.
Wonderful, Mary. Wow, that was incredible. Carly, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, this is why we needed Mary on the show to do this incredible analysis for us. So I'm just so incredibly thankful. So in terms of my notes, I don't have a ton that we haven't touched on. You know, one thing I was kind of curious about was Emily has like a quote unquote normal name and Tigran. I've never met a Tigran in my life. Maybe Tigran is, you know, an earthly name. Maybe it's not. And then we have the Verdanthi and all this stuff. So I'm like, okay, that's interesting to me that she had a more straightforward name. And then I don't know. So that just posed some questions for me about whether she was from that world or maybe she wasn't. Maybe she's from a different world and that's why she has a different name. So anyway, that was something that just flagged for me as something that stood out. Considering there was so much intention put into the world building here that she was given the name Emily. I think there's a lot of things that are really interesting in terms of the actual plot itself, like the gaps in time, the memory loss, the strange occurrences. Like, I like that we're working towards something here that is going to surprise us in a way that is possibly unsettling for the character as well. I thought that was really interesting. You know, in terms of the hook, that left me something to be discovered because at the top it says, a standalone novel exploring self-destruction and self-discovery. That's something I would flag in any query letter where I would really like to know what's actually going to potentially happen in a hook-ish sort of way as a opposed to these larger themes. So that was what stood out for me.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, can you give us an overview of what was in the opening pages?
All right, so we start with one of the things that was alluded to in the query letter, which is one of these kind of missions where it's sabotage or some warfare in the community. So we start with him kind of waiting for a gang of Verdanthi grunts to appear. He's waiting for them. His tongue is craving whiskey. He's kind of wet and he's noticing things like, you know, there's mold and commenting on the rain and talking about the situation in terms of the physical environment. Then some Verdanthi appear and he comments on them. They said they almost look human. They almost move human. So we're kind of starting to understand what they look like a little bit. We know that there are a couple people with him. He names a couple people that are kind of in this ragtag gang. There is what he calls an EMP device that essentially is going to blow up. It's an electronic device that's essentially going to render all their comms devices useless. But they know this and they're kind of willing to do this for the cause. And so they spot some people in the alley and they kind of continue on with their gunfire between the Verdanthi and these people.
Great, Carly. Thank you. Okay, Mary, we're handing it across to you.
Yes. So with this one, you know, it's very classic. It's classic sci-fi. Again, without comp titles, I'm not quite sure, but I'm guessing this is where Drew is going for. And he's nailing it. You know, it's really intense world building. You've got, you know, the really fun sort of aliens. You've got explosions. You've got all of the things. And I think he does a really good job with the world building. And there's a great voice and there's a great atmosphere. But that being said, so in his case, he's actually got a higher hill to climb than Sherry did because he's nailing this commercial sci-fi writing and he's really kind of classic in it, but that's not gonna sell. You know, in order for this something like this to sell, we really have to have something a little bit fresh. And you know, I think in Drew's case particularly, it's like the little bit of the sense of humor can draw that out. And so I would say like there's two things here: drawing out more of the humor, more of the sort of fun kind of idea behind his sort of devil may care, you know, I drink whiskey and kind of this concept, but as well, you know, with the pitch explained, you know, really giving us like, this is different because of that. And the other thing I will mention is, you know, and Carly kind of talked a little bit about this idea, this concept of Emily. I'm not sure if he meant to do this, but in my head, I'm assuming Emily is actually the weapon of mass destruction. Like that's the big reveal at the end. And that's kind of the idea I got. That might just be me, you know, reading in between the lines and being absolutely incorrect. But if I'm correct, it does mean that Drew, but your writing is very classic, you know, and I was able to kind of like figure out what was going on just because it's so classic. And so that's just something to think about, you know, that if you're writing this classic sci-fi, you're doing a good job. It's good prose. You know, I'm not telling you that you need to, you know, go back and workshop over and over again the like prose itself. But I do think that, you know, you've got a high hill to climb because you're not making this stand out at this point. So that's just that would be my feedback on that.
Wonderful, Mary. Thank you. Okay, Carly, anything to add there?
Yeah, so just starting on the first page, there's a bit of a repetition about the whiskey bit. And it's obviously like it's a bit, right? Because it's trying to obviously tell us some things about the character. But on the second line, it says, my tongue wants whiskey. And then about 8 lines later, it says, or for your tongue to crave whiskey in the midst of it all. So it's kind of just like doubling down on that bit. So I don't think we need that. It's just a reminder to everybody. Sometimes when we're trying to communicate something in our opening pages, we tend to repeat ourselves because we want to make sure that the reader gets it. But repetition that early on just tells me maybe we just didn't do a really close line edit, or you were back in there and editing things before you sent it off, which happens, right? But again, just a reminder, this is an educational platform and we're here for educational advice. But when you're sending to agents, those are the type of things that you're going to want to look out for. One of the things that I liked about these pages was we were drawing attention to like the humanness of our character, like them being earthlings, and then obviously a contrast to like what is alien. So I liked that we were trying to bring that humanness to these characters and make that very clear. And I think there was a good job of that. There was a sign that said a Theranops, and then our character goes like, what the F is Theranops? Why do we as humans always try to be so damn clever when we name something? And so it's like leaning on that humanity and that like psychology of being human in this other world. I liked that type of work. And I did like, again, this idea. I mentioned this when I was doing the page summary, but like they look almost human. They move almost human. But I couldn't really visualize them as much as I wanted to. In what ways do they almost look human? And in what ways do they almost move human? And what ways do they not act human? Maybe this is something we get to a few pages later, but that's something that I would be pretty interested in. I would be interested also in just being really clear about what this like mission is in the opening pages. Like we get this idea that they're trying to cause problems or kind of like rebels and there's gunfire back and forth. We all know that happens, but what is the goal there? Was it really to like take everybody out? Was it to send a message to the leader? Like I would have just loved like a goal for them in that specific scene that obviously leads towards the larger goals, but just gunfire for the sake of gunfire felt like there was just a lack of stakes there for that exact moment. And I just would have liked a little bit more of that.
Awesome, Carly. Thank you so much. Mary, thank you so much for joining us. This was incredible, incredible insight on a genre that we don't discuss nearly enough. Thank you just for all of that. It was awesome.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
I hope we can have Mary back again. I know all of our sci-fi listeners are going to be like, please, hell yeah, get her back again. And we will try again in the future. Thank you to Carly, Cece, and Mary for the wonderful feedback. Now let's go to today's guest.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast-track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronouncing words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That we want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Hello, listeners. This is Cece. Question for you. What do all the very best stories have in common? The ability to make us feel. Which is why learning how to weave emotions into your writing is so important. And I am so excited to announce that I am teaching my super popular writing emotion class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, August 8th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time via Zoom to learn all about the craft of writing emotions, common mistakes, tips and tricks, and lots of practical examples from novels and memoirs you love. Then we'll meet again on Monday, August 12th. For a live cozy Q&A session in which you will have the option to turn on your camera and ask questions in real time. If you can't attend one or both sessions live, make sure to sign up because everyone who is registered before August 8th will get recordings 24 hours later. For more information, head to my Instagram profile and click on the link in my bio. I hope to see you there.
Today's guest is the author of the national bestseller and Library Reads pick Same Time Next Summer and the Indie Next and Library Reads pick Nora Goes Off Script. She lives in Rye, New York with her family. It's my pleasure to welcome Annabelle Monahan. Annabelle, welcome to the show.
I am so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you here. This has been 3 years in the making and we finally managed to make it happen after I stalked you on social media and kind of browbeat you into it. So thanks for that. So for our listeners, I'm just going to read you the flap copy for Annabelle's latest book, Summer Romance. And then as per usual, we're going to dive in. Ali Morris is a professional organizer whose own life is a mess. Her mom died 2 years ago. Then her husband left, and she hasn't worn pants with a zipper in longer than she cares to remember. No one is more surprised when Ali, when the first time she takes off her wedding ring and puts on pants with hardware, overalls count, right? She meets someone unexpected from her past. Or rather, her dog claims a man for her in the same way he claimed his favorite of her three children, by peeing on him. Ethan smiles at Ali like her pants are just right, like he likes what he sees. The last thing newly single mom Ali needs is to make her life messier, but there's no harm in a little summer romance, is there? Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
I mean, a lot of meet cutes are a lot wetter and a lot less urination, but I am loving this one. How did you come up with this? Does your dog pee on people?
You know, yes. And I hate, this is why I don't go to the dog park anymore. I went one time when I first had my dog and I showed up at the dog park and he was so excited. He ran over to this lady in flip-flops and peed on her feet. And I apologized and got back in the car and I never have returned. That is a thing that my dog does. But, you know, that's it's an act of love. And there's nothing that I like more in a book than an awkward situation. I feel like I spend my whole life trying to create an awkward situation. And that is one of the more awkward situations I've ever been in.
I absolutely love that. We had a puppy in our building that every time it saw me, it would pee on my shoes. And I love that. I felt like I went out into the world thus anointed. My dog, who passed away a month ago, Muggle, she would go into the park and she would find a boy dog with the fluffiest face. And then she would hump his face. But like for 5 or 10 minutes, and it was really embarrassing. And the one day my husband was in the park with me, and he's got a very dry sense of humor, and he turned to the person next to him and he said, "She gets that from her mother." So you can imagine how well that went down in terms of awkward conversation starters in the park.
Yes, it does bring up a visual that I'm trying to clear, but it's sticking in my mind.
Judging by the expression on this person's face, it stuck as well. So there we go.
Yeah.
Right. So before we discuss this particular book, Annabelle, I'd love to look at your journey to publication, because you published two YA novels, I think 2012, 2014, and then you blew onto the scene with Nora Goes Off Script in 2022. So that was like an 8 to 10 year gap in between. And from what I can understand, I think it was in that time that you were writing the column, "Does This Volvo Make My Butt Look Big?" Can you tell us a bit more about the column? Was it a way for you to sharpen your voice? And why did you decide on the sort of change from YA to rom-com, women's fiction? If you can just take us through that.
So, you know, it's funny. I always wanted to write a novel from the time I was 6 years old. It took me a really long time to get started. And I wrote A Girl Named Digit, my first young adult novel. And I think that when I started doing that, I was very afraid. I was very afraid of writing. I was very afraid of putting myself out there. And I don't even think I appreciated at the time how much I would be putting myself out there. So starting with young adults, I think that on some level, there was a little emotional distance because, you know, I was writing about a 17-year-old, which is very much revealing about who I was when I was 17, but also who cares who I was when I was 17. So that felt like a safe place for me to start. So I wrote those books. Those books were, the people who read them liked them. Not that many people read them. They were, you know, not even a moderate success. And at the same time, my local paper was looking for somebody to just write a column, like a lifestyle column. And I tried that. And for whatever reason, over a couple of years, that column became much more successful than my young adult novels. And it got picked up by a bunch of other publications, and it became a thing. And it was during that time that I got comfortable writing in my grown-up voice. I was writing about my own life. I was writing about living in a family and being married and raising children. And that was really putting myself out there in a huge way. And I got comfortable with it, and I developed that voice. And that was all really terrific. 2020 rolls around, the world shuts down, it gets really quiet. I had all my children home from college, and everybody was sleeping until noon every day. And so I just started waking up really early, and I heard my own voice, and I started writing Nora Goes Off Script. So that was, and I was 50 years old when I did that. So, you know, I wrote the first thing that I ever wrote that anyone really cared about when I was 50 years old.
I absolutely love that. Now, was it a case of, because so much time had passed, that you then had to get a new agent? Or was it like, "Hey, old agent, haven't heard from me in a while, but I'm working on something new"? What did that look like?
Yes, it was kind of a crazy thing. You know, in my overly enthusiastic way, I emailed my old agent and I said, "I've written a grown-up novel." And I was so excited. And she replied, "Great, send it." And then I never heard from her for 6 months. And, you know, it was COVID and it was a weird time. And we were all, you know, we all thought we were dying. So it was just strange. And after 6 months, I emailed again and I said, "Have you read my," and I didn't hear anything back. And so I went and I got another agent and I queried and I listened to your podcast, like it was my job to get that done. And then I reached out to my original agent and said, "I just wanted to let you know I got a new agent." She said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, it's been COVID. I never read your manuscript." So now I have a new agent, and that's been amazing. She sold Nora right away, and then many subsequent books after that.
I love that. And of course, somebody jumped at it, and of course, it sold quickly because it was such a wonderful book. And here we are, three books later. Something I want to ask you about is I think you tweeted or you put it on Threads yesterday. And I want to discuss this because this is something that rom-com or romance authors get all the time, and it is so infuriating. somebody said to you, you seem smart, why do you write romance? And you were like, don't worry, I handled it. But like, is this something you get a lot of? And where the hell do you think this comes from?
I'm not really sure where it comes from, except that, you know, there's an association with fluffiness that goes with a romance. There is an assumption that everything is very formulaic, which there's always a happy ending, but frankly, getting there, I mean, I wish there was a formula to get there because I would be working a lot less hard. It is very hard to get to the end of a love story and have it all work out in a way that's satisfying. And, you know, if you're a smart person, you should be writing smart things and they should be confusing and mysterious and everyone should have to work really hard to read them and they should be taught in schools. You know, there's this belief in that. And boy, I think that life is kind of hard. I think life has probably always been hard, feels kind of hard right now in the world. I just don't think there's anything wrong with using your full mental capacity and all of your energy to create something that feels like a break for people, feels like a release, feels like just, you know, a moment of joy. So I don't know. That is one of the most annoying comments that I get. And also, I know that romance readers also get the same comment. You know, why do you waste your time? You know what's going to happen.
Yeah, there's something in Canada with CanLit, you know, we've got big literary prizes here, which they have in the US, etc. But it's this kind of literary snobbery that the book needs to be as obscure as possible, that you read it and you actually don't know what the bloody hell is happening. And you have to read it and read it again, and you still actually don't know what the hell's happening. I feel a lot of this is like the emperor's new clothes, right? Nobody wants to say that the emperor's naked. You've all got to ooh and ah over the emperor's clothes. And a lot of the time people are like, oh, this book was, you know, it was phenomenal. But most of the time, I think people just don't know what the hell the damn book was about. And they feel stupid if they say they don't know what the book's about.
Yeah, I agree. And I have a thing personally where if I'm asking someone what their favorite book is, and it is, you know, Remembrance of Things Past by Proust, I think I'm going to watch this because I'm not going to trust anything that you say from here out. I have a great respect for people who are intelligent enough to say things in a simple way. And I think, well, I can think of a lot of examples, but there are a lot of really smart people who can explain things and they can explain how things work. And I just think that that's a really nice way to communicate. And I think there are a lot of people who just try to make things more complicated than they need to be.
Excellent point, because, you know, my husband works in banking, and I think the people there, and same as in tech and in IT, the people who get paid a lot are the people who are able to take really complex concepts and are able to make the average person understand them. And because it's a skill, it's something it's really difficult to do. And when I do manuscript evaluations or when I'm in teacher mode, I will look at people who submit things and they'll be like, oh, this is literary fiction. And it isn't actually literary fiction. It's just that they've tried to take something really simple and they've tried to make it sound as convoluted and as highbrow as possible. I often refer to friends on the show, and there was an episode where Joey had a thesaurus and he changed every word with the thesaurus to make him sound as smart as he possibly could. But often what I'm saying to students is, I'll highlight a whole paragraph and I'm like, how can you say this in the simplest, most direct way and in a conversational way? Because when you write something that's overly formal, it sounds academic, it sounds like corporate speak, and it's not going into your reader's head in a way that the reader feels like you having a conversation with them. Like, how important is that conversation with your reader in terms of the tone?
No, I agree. And also, it's very hard to get into somebody's heart that way. You can get into somebody's head, you know, by giving them a math formula, but to get into somebody's heart, you have to be having a conversation with them. And those are my favorite kinds of books to read.
Okay, so here's the opening sentence. Sometimes you just have to throw shit in the pantry, which immediately made me laugh because, one, you're not expecting this from a professional organizer. two rom-coms, you get told, stay away from the curse words because the readers are going to complain. So Annabelle, take us through your opening sentence.
My opening sentence is, I should have a tattoo that says that. It's basically, so much in this book is an inside joke between my husband and me. He is a person who would love to have a pantry that was organized with baskets and color-coded, and he'd love to be married to a person like that. That's not what happened to him. I am a person who goes to the grocery store and literally throws shit in the pantry and then closes it. I never look at it again. And the whole purpose of this book, or at least my starting point for this book, is to explore the difference between our external lives and our internal lives. The way we present ourselves to the world, you know, on Instagram or just out socially, and the way we actually live, the way our homes are and the way we are inside. And so that was my starting point, was her admitting that you just don't always have to be so organized all the time.
Yeah, and that's like the personal universal element that makes the reader immediately connect with the character, because we don't want to hear about perfect people. We don't want to read about people who've got their shit together so much that they make us feel bad about ourselves. And when there's a shortcut to a character where they have this vulnerability of this little quirk that they do, and we're like, oh, that's exactly like me, we're already predisposed to getting on board with them.
Yes.
Okay, so I want to discuss the efficiency of rom-coms. So in general, when you're looking at certain genres, you get told, don't start with too much backstory. Don't start with too much exposition. Don't start with grief, right? Because this means the character is struggling with something which might lead to more passive emotions, etc. When we read rom-coms, we get straight into it. We find out very quickly what the person does for a living. We find out the context of why they are where they are. We don't need to go back 2 years to the moment when something happened to see why they are where they are. And that's the efficiency of rom-coms that I really appreciate, that we can say to the reader, this is what's happened. This is where the character is. This is who they are. And now we can move the story forward. Now, we begin with Ali, who is talking about winging it. She doesn't tell these kinds of things to her clients in terms of just throwing shit in the pantry. She says, it's no secret that I'm more than a little stuck. I'm in a holding pattern, like a plane trying to land in too much fog. I'm here, but also not here. Married, but also not. Instagram thinks I need to engage in some serious self-care to get me back living my best life. They're obsessed with my cortisol levels and the depth of my meditation practice. She talks about, it says, today is the 2-year anniversary of my mother's death, which makes it the 1-year anniversary of the day Pete announced he didn't want to be married to me anymore. I mean, this is like bad things upon bad things. This is grief upon grief. Can I just say, we immediately freaking hate Pete? He's the absolute bloody worst. What kind of a person ends a marriage on the 1-year anniversary of someone's mother dying? So I'm thinking, Annabelle, you started where you started here because you did not want to start with the grief of the mom dying or being mired in the grief of Pete deciding he wanted a divorce. You needed Ali to be far enough in the future that there was potential for her to start to move on from this.
Yes, exactly. And I find, well, there's so many things that are really challenging about writing a book. Knowing where to start your book is so challenging to me. I think I started this book in a lot of different ways. And I think originally her mother had died 5 years ago. Because I've lost my mother, I know that it really doesn't feel that much better 5 years later. But I wanted the grief to feel a little bit more immediate. And I also knew that I wanted her to move on into this summer romance. So I wanted there to be a certain amount of time that felt appropriate after separation from her husband. But I think the way that it's written, because I know what you mean. You don't want to just like dump a bunch of tragedy in the first 3 pages, which is frankly what I did. She seems okay. She seems fine. She's, you know, greeting her plants on the way out. She's on the phone with her friend. She's, you know, going to go out with her dog. And it all feels a little bit hopeful. Hopefully it doesn't feel like, oh, I'm so sad, I can't move.
Yeah, no, not at all. But we do know that she's grappling with stuff, right? And so these are things that happened in the past, but you still needed an inciting incident because you still need to answer the why now, why today question. Why does the story start now? And that happens when Pete phones and says, okay, it's been a year. I want to start divorce proceedings. And that's what leads her to take off her ring. And then that's when the dominoes start tipping over in terms of causality for the rest of the story. So when you started with it being 5 years in the future, was it still the same beginning and it was just 5 years later? Or was there a point at which you were moving the puzzle pieces around to find your way into the story?
No, I think that it was still the day that Pete said he wanted a divorce. So it was just the mother had died a lot earlier. But I think what I was trying to do there was to show, and I really love your questions, by the way, because I don't think this deeply about what I write, but I really do love thinking about this. I wanted to show how the inciting incident does not need to be an explosion. It does not need to be a letter that says, you know, your father isn't who you thought he was, you're really royalty. It can just be as small as finally taking off your wedding ring. And it can be something that you do, that you, you know, I wanted to show a woman who was stuck, and I think everybody's been stuck. I've been stuck in my life many times, and how just, it's not a huge thing to get out of it. You know, put on a pair of hard pants, leave the house. That's a step forward. So that's what I was trying to do there.
Yeah, no, and you absolutely achieved it. And that is so important for our listeners. You know, your inciting incident doesn't need to be a big explosion. It doesn't need to be bullets raining. It is sometimes it's this quietness of a person making a decision for themselves. So we've got the emotionality, we have the interiority. Just remember that it needs to reflect in the actual plot in terms of forward motion, in terms of action. So it can't just be a character sitting by themselves, making this decision about their life, and then we don't see how they act on it. So we need to see physical action tied to emotionality and interiority, which is what we see here. She gets the phone call, takes her wedding ring off, which is this external manifestation, and she goes out. And this sets everything in motion because without taking the wedding ring off and without going out, what follows wouldn't have happened. So before we move on to some of the other parts of writing a rom-com, you know, writing about grief in a rom-com is something that you wouldn't necessarily expect. And it wasn't depressing at all. There were these touching moments where you just see where she would want to speak to her mother, where something quiet would happen in the day and she would think about her mother. And you know, that completely negates the whole fluffiness that people are always talking about when it comes to rom-com, because grief is not fluffy. And you had to tackle that in a way that was authentic, that really resonated with the reader, that had true emotion attached, but that wasn't so depressing that the reader would stop reading. That is one hell of a balancing and juggling act. So can we speak a bit about that?
Wow. Thank you. You know, grief is not fluffy. Also, I would add that love is not fluffy. Living in a family is not fluffy. Raising a teenager is not fluffy. These are all just some of the things in life that can actually take you down. And, you know, the choices that women make in their lives frequently that put everybody ahead of themselves and get them away from the thing they originally wanted to do, that stuff to me is not fluffy. And that's the stuff that we're tackling over and over again in all sorts of fiction. So again, to the person who is denouncing the romance novel, I do not like it. I did not plan to write a book about grief. It's not really a book about grief, but I did not plan for her mother to actually be deceased when I first started writing this book. And I was writing her in her pantry and she was thinking about her marriage. And suddenly she appeared to me as a person who had lost her mother. And I don't really know where that came from, but it sort of made sense to me because I thought in this moment, I would, if I was in this situation, I would want to talk to my mother about whatever this was. And then I knew that her mother had passed. And I think that her moving through this grief in a way that is fun for the reader, because she's still in contact with her mother. In the book, she talks to her mother in the car all the time and sort of hears her mother back, but you know, through her own memory. It's fun. And I think that we don't need to show our characters in the fetal position sobbing. We can just have the taste of the grief, you know, just the feel of it as they're moving into something as fun as dating a skateboarder.
Yeah, I love the skateboarder vibe. There were a whole bunch of things about this that I was not expecting. Okay, so you're not expecting an adult skateboarder because you're expecting that in a YA novel. You're not expecting, quite honestly, the main character to have three children. You know, there's so many rom-coms where she's single and she's, you know, 27 and she's hot and she's this and that. It was lovely to see an older protagonist who has children, who's going through, you know, is about to go through the mess of the divorce, etc. And here is this skater guy. I don't want to give away too much about who he's revealed to be, etc. But, you know, how much do you sit and plot when it comes to the premise, Annabelle? Do you go, these are the tropes I want, these are the tropes I'm going to avoid? Or is it like writing in the moment and the mom's just there and you're like, cool, the mom's just there and I'm going to go with that?
Yeah, this is where I always hesitate to talk about writing because I just don't want anyone to write the way I do. It is not the right way to go. It's not a smart way to go. I start with a premise. I mean, frankly, I started this book. She was a professional organizer who's stuck and her life is a mess. And she needs to clean her house. And probably because I needed to clean my house. That was all I started with. And I never think about the tropes that end up happening. You know, trope is a word that I didn't know until after I published Nora Goes Off Script. I kept hearing the word. They're not something that I think about. I do, you know, in terms of her being older and having children, I love writing that. And I think that I love writing mothers with children because it's, you know, it makes everything just a little bit more complicated for your character. It adds so many constraints and so many limitations. And frankly, a single mother only has so much time during the day for romance. This cannot go on all night because her kids are going to come home from school. So I do love that. And I kind of, the book that I'm writing right now, she doesn't have children. And that's fun in and of itself because she has all the time in the world. And, you know, she could cancel her plans. She could call in sick for work. But I do like the constraints of motherhood.
Yeah, it added other layers. It added more depth to a, you know, a rom-com in terms of a genre we've seen before. We know we want the happy ending or the happy for now. But it really just adds layers of depth along the way in terms of conflict and tension. And, you know, is he going to like her children? Because this is as important as him liking her, etc. So what I want to speak about is the push and pull required in romance, in rom-coms, in the, we get to a certain point, we feel all the feels, we feel the magic, the sparks are happening, but it can't happen right now because of X, Y, and Z. And then we've got to move it to the next thing. And then we need that tension again. So again, is that something that you plot out saying, okay, this is the moment at which they're going to get together and these are the obstacles I need to put in their way, these misunderstandings, these whatever they may be? Or again, is it you organically feel your way into the story, you get to a certain point and then you go, okay, I have to complicate their lives right now to ensure that push and pull?
Yeah, so that's very hard. I think that breaking up your couple is the hardest part of this kind of a book. I can't think of a single time book that I've written where I knew how that was going to happen. And I love the love part. I love the meeting. I love the falling in love. I love the tension. I love all the physicality. And then I think, good Lord, I just don't know where I'm going to go from here. And then I have to figure that out. And I go back to the beginning of the book. And I start the book over, or, you know, I start revising to make whatever that is make sense. But it's difficult. I mean, it's two people who love each other in this day and age. I mean, we're not living on the prairie. People can travel to see each other. They can, you know, there are no limitations. So it is very difficult to keep a couple apart.
Yeah, and you can't have sort of misunderstandings or missed letters like they used to be. People can text each other.
Right.
People these days go for therapy. They are taught how to become emotionally well-adjusted human beings who communicate their needs and their feelings, etc. So it is. It's so much harder these days for rom-com writers to write these kinds of things than before when, you know, guys just didn't have a clue. Letters got lost. People weren't home when you called them. But you do have to torture your characters along the way, because I think that is really what makes for a good rom-com.
And when you think about Pride and Prejudice, which I think about all the time, that was, it was just such a perfect time for that book. And she's wandering the moors thinking about Mr. Darcy. And there he is. I mean, it to me, that is just the absolute ultimate. And it would never happen now. You'd check his Instagram. You'd know exactly where he was.
Yeah, in this book, your character goes in search of him and she doesn't find him where she expects to find him, and then he's kind of somewhere else. But like you say, exactly, these days you're like, okay. And women these days can do things that's socially acceptable that, you know, Elizabeth Bennet was not able to do.
Yes.
So there's that as well. Annabelle, it's been such a joy chatting with you. For our listeners, I loved Summer Romance. Get it. Put it in your beach bag. Go and enjoy it. It's just, there's just so many levels there. There's so much to enjoy. We're going to link to it on our bookshop.org affiliate page. Buy the book there and support your local independent bookstore, and you will support the podcast at the same time. Annabelle, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, Mike, this is a dream come true. I am such a longtime fan of yours, so thank you for having me.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamurray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be.